So let me tell you a story. Some of you may know this one. There was a woman who was standing in front of a Picasso painting. She had one hand on her hip, and her lips were tight, and her brow was furrowed, and she looked at it in several different ways, and she muttered very loudly, "That's not a cow." Well, Picasso was standing not far away, and he heard this. And so he wandered over casually and stood next to her, kind of gazing at the painting. And then he leaned over to her and said quietly, "Madam, you are correct. That is not a cow. That is a picture of a cow." So we all create pictures in our minds, all kinds of images of what's going on, and then we confuse the picture in our mind with the reality out there. We do this all the time. I had an interesting, for me, a whole new perspective on this first of the year. My oldest son gave me a book for Christmas. It was called Cat Sense. I don't know if any of you have seen it. I'd never heard of it. I've had cats all my life, and I've always enjoyed them. And this is about how cats sense and think and feel and how they relate to the world. And it wasn't written by somebody sitting in a Disney studio kind of imagining what it might be like to be a cat. But it was a collection of like all the research, scientific research on how cats operate. So for example, cats have very large eyes, these huge eyes, and they don't have irises, but the slits that open up, so they can take in a vast amount of light. So the night vision is much, much better than ours. But they're almost completely blind in bright light. You know, they can't see, it's too much. And those large eyes mean they can see at great distances. But they have trouble focusing on anything that's any closer than about 12 or 18 inches to them. And it's one of the reasons they have those long whiskers, they sense it. And if you have a cat that's raised inside all the time, actually the shape of the eye will change a little bit if they're never focusing long distance. But cats in the wild are very farsighted. And so when they're running through a field, what they're actually doing is they're creating a map of the field ahead of them. And when they put their foot down, they're not actually looking physically where their foot is, but they're using the map in their mind. Yeah, so it's interesting to think about. And of course, and another thing about them is like dogs, they have their sense of smell is maybe 1,000 times better than ours. And so they have a very refined sense. And they map the world a lot through smells. And for us as humans, you know, our sense of smell is pretty crude. And so I can't even quite imagine what a smell map. I can imagine a little bit, but I don't think it's anything what it's like. So when we come to humans, we humans have very, very different maps of the world. If you look at, let's say, a Tea Party enthusiast and a liberal progressive, right? They'll look at the world, they'll look at the news, they'll look at what's going on, and they'll have a completely different map of what's going on out there. Or if you imagine a 3-year-old and a 30-year-old walking through a zoo, they're really in very different places. Or a Buddhist, a fundamentalist Christian, a Muslim, and an atheist. When they ask those big questions, they have very different maps. And in fact, the police will tell you that if you're looking for accurate information about what happened, let's say in a car accident, they'll say the worst, the most unreliable information are eyewitnesses. Because the maps get very, very distorted. So, Uspensky once said, "I found that the chief difficulty for most people was to realize that they rarely heard new things, that is, things that they had never heard before. They kept translating what they heard into their habitual language." They had ceased to hope and believe there might be anything new. And the human brain, our senses, filter out probably 99.99% of the information that comes to us. So it's out of this little sliver that we create this whole map of what we think the world is we're living in. So you'll find attributed to Eastern religions a lot this phrase that the world is an illusion, sounding like the world is a figment of our imagination. But in Buddhism, that's not what they're saying. There is a real world out there. It's just that the maps that we create of it are so distorted that what we see is more like a mirage. You know, mirage is you're driving down the highway and there's water down there, and you say, well, it's not real, it's a mirage. No, it actually is real. You're actually seeing the sky being reflected off the highway by hot and cold air bends the light. So the phenomena you see is actually quite real. It's just the mind says it's water when it isn't. Mm-hmm. So it's just our interpretation is off. Okay, so that's where we begin. And what the what Buddhism is then is a phenomenology. It's not a metaphysics, it's not a set of beliefs, it's not a philosophy, it's not a social psychology, it is actually a phenomenology. That means it's an exploration of our actual experience. And what the Buddha discovered is that we don't have to have answers to all those big questions. Is there God? What's God? Why do bad things happen to good people? What happens when we die? All those things. All that we need, the only thing that we need to find the deepest, fullest well-being is to actually just see clearly what the heck it is we're actually experiencing. Which seems kind of tepid or something, right? But that's where it actually comes from. So one expression of Buddhism as a phenomenology, one of the earliest expressions of this, was what are called these five khandhas. As I say, they're just collections or clusters of phenomena. And there are five of them. Raw sensation, feeling tone, perception. Fourth khanda is thoughts and concepts and ideas, all those maps that we draw. And then the fifth one is awareness itself. And if you think about those five, right? Sensations, feelings, perception, thoughts, awareness, that covers the whole gamut of what we can experience. And so what the Buddha was saying essentially in this is that there are different areas of experience, and don't confuse them. Picture of a cow is not a cow. How many of you have heard that story before? A few of you. How many of you read it in my book? Okay, good. I mean, because I wrote a whole chapter in Buddha's map on the khandhas, and I thought, if a whole lot of people have read it, I just, you know, because I put everything I know about khandhas in there, and I thought, so what am I going to do if a lot of people read it? Well, actually, I'm going to say come at this some different angles. The chapter on the khandhas was the most difficult chapter in the whole book. I had a first draft of about 3/4 of the manuscript, and I showed it to one of my teachers, Bhante Vimalaramsi, because I just wanted to make sure I was on the right track. And he said, yeah, no, it's good. There's a few things I want to tweak. But he said, your chapters in the khandhas is all wrong. And so I sat down with him. I said, okay, so fill me in. And he said, you know, there's these five. There's sensations and feeling tone and perception and thought forms and awareness. And I said, okay, but what are those? And he wasn't real clear about it. So I talked to other scholars and other teachers and got basically the same thing. They all say there are these five aggregates, these five khandhas affected by craving and clinging, and they're all not self. And I say, so what? So what it's really about? And none of them really knew. And then around that time, I had just joined this Sutta study group that Tony Bernard runs. Some of you know him. He comes over here once a year. So I asked him the same question, and he gave me the same answer. But, he said, there's this woman in England. Her name is Sue Hamilton. And she's a scholar who really specializes on what she calls the worldview in the earliest Pali Canon. So it's the worldview expressed in the earliest records of the Buddha's talks. So if you can get that worldview, you kind of begin to understand what the people who were listening to him might have been thinking. So I got one of her books, and there was about four or five pages in it on the khandhas. And they seemed the clearest thing I'd ever seen. And she kept on referring to this earlier writing, which was actually her doctoral dissertation that had been published. And it was out of print. But I found I could get it for $75. So I bought it. I had this whole book holding up on it. And it's a doctoral dissertation. If you want to read it, it's written defensively. You know, there are sentences that seem to go on for half a page at a time. And it's got more footnotes than text. And it's very, very thick and hard going. But she had a really, really clear sense of what they were. So for me, as a Buddhist nerd, it was actually... it was fun, actually, digging the stuff out of there. And she said that one of the reasons nobody knows what the khandhas were was the Buddha never said what they were. He talks about these five aggregates, these five clusters, but he never talked about what they were. And she uses the analogy of a computer, which is kind of fun, just a picture of the Buddha sitting there typing on a computer. And the computer has a keyboard, and it has a screen, and it has a processor, and a mouse, and a hard drive. And she said, it's as if people come along and say, so, Sir Gotama, what is the computer? Is it the keyboard? That's what you're working on. And he says, no, the computer isn't the keyboard. It's this whole collection of stuff. Don't worry about it. What's important is how it all works together and how you use this thing. So somebody's listening and say, oh, so what you're saying is that the essence of the computer is in the monitor. And he would say again, no, don't worry about it. It's not the monitor. It's the whole, you just don't worry about what it is. It's how it all works together. And somebody, I know, it's the processor. And he says, it's a stupid question. he wasn't talking about computers, but he was talking about self. And so what he was interested in, how all of these things work together to create a sense of self. So what I want to do tonight, because this can get really dry if you go at it with the kind of enthusiasm I have for arcane manuscripts. But what I would like to do is to just give you a sweep through the five khandhas and how they actually operate together. Because some of you who have read a little bit about this stuff, I've never heard anybody talk about how they operate together. And they're really a kind of a dependent origination light. Dependent origination, how everything arises because of a cause. Buddha said, that's the whole of his teaching. If you can get that, you get the whole works. Well, dependent origination has 12 links, or 9, or 11, or 13, or 23, depending on which talk you're listening to. And people just get totally lost in the individual ones. But you got five, and so you can kind of see it. So we'll take a whole sweep through the khandhas. I'll do this quickly. And then I've got a khandha game that we'll play. And I've got some rewards here for people who have right answers. And then I want to have us look in depth at the first of these clusters, which are actually physical sensations. And the way I want to do this is invite you, all of us, to talk about any stuff that comes up that you experience in meditation. And some of them are weird and strange phenomena, some of them are quite normal, but we'll just kind of talk about what those are. So we can get, and then I want to leave a chunk of time at the end that's basically take up the question, so what? You know, what difference does this make, either in meditation or in our life? But since I was given this topic to talk about the khandhas, I don't think we can get to that until at least we kind of understand what we're talking about. Okay? I hope it is, because I don't know what else I would do if you said no. So, the first khanda, the first cluster, the first aggregate is called rupa, R-U-P-A, and Pali is the term for it, which is usually translated as body. But there's another word in Pali. Forgive me using all these terms. You know, it's important to understand the terms a little bit because so much gets lost in translation. And a lot of people read this stuff as if the Buddha was talking in English. But words don't translate from one language to another. I don't know if you know, when Pepsi went into China, they took their slogan, come alive with the Pepsi generation, and translated into Chinese. And in Chinese, it came across, Pepsi brings your ancestors back from the dead. When Frank Perdue took his chicken into Mexico, they had this slogan, it takes a tough man to make a tender chicken. And when they translated into into Spanish, it came through, it takes an aroused man to make a chicken affectionate. No, it takes an aroused man to make a chicken affectionate. But my favorite one of these mistranslations is when Ford tried to sell Pintos in Brazil. And the sales were terrible. And they couldn't figure out what it was until somebody told them that in Brazil, Pinto is slang for small penis. So they changed the name to Corel, which is Portuguese for horse. And sales took off. forgive me, I just want to take a little bit of time with some of the language so you can kind of get a sense of when the Buddha was talking to people what they were hearing, because it may be a little different than us. So rupa is usually translated as body. There's this other word in Pali called kaya, which also means body. And it refers to the body as substance, you know, bone and flesh and organs and blood and that sort of stuff. Rupa also refers to that, but it refers to an animated body. So a corpse could be a kaya, but a corpse would never be rupa. So rupa, this first khanda, refers to a body that is alive and operating, that sees and hears and tastes and feels, that's alive and operating. So what's most important there is that all the senses are operating. So I translate it kind of loosely, but I think it's the core of it, as raw sensation. Raw sensation. Let me give just a couple of examples just to get a feel for this. So imagine you're walking, you know, into a dark room and you're feeling around, and you feel something that's cold and smooth and hard, and you have no idea what it is. Right? So those are the actual sensations. When you get an idea what it is, that moves on to something else. Is anybody here familiar with the Swiss psychologist Jean Piaget? There's a couple of you. Yeah. Yeah, he did a lot of really groundbreaking work, 50 or 60 years ago, on the development of intelligence in children. And he was a very, very, very keen observer. And he loved this. He said that intelligence actually begins at the surface of the organism, where you make contact with the environment. So what happens is there is this raw sensation There's a touch, a feel, or light hits your eye, or sound hits your eardrum, and there's a sensation. And then we start to extrapolate out, to imagine out what may have caused that sensation, and we extrapolate in to figure out who it is that actually felt it. Mm-hmm. But the further we get away from the actual raw experience, the shakier the ground is we're on. Because the only thing we ever know is just that direct experience. So that's rupa. Somebody have a question or something? I used to tell my congregation, I used to say, you know, my job is to speak, and your job is to listen. And if you finish your job before I finish mine, just raise your hand or let me know or something, because I'd rather do this as a discussion anyway. Well, that's enough.
I'm troubled. I'm not sure if I heard you correctly, but you said you were talking about both inward and outward perception, and the only thing that was really real was the initial sensation?
The only, that comes as close to the truth of what we know, because from there we start extrapolating. So I don't know if you know this story, I think Joseph Goldstein tells it, of, stop me if I share it before, there was this couple that bought a new house, and they were very thrilled to move into it. And the first morning they woke up, there was a bird in the basement. And they were so delighted that this bird had moved into the basement. And so they decided they weren't going to go down there because they didn't want to scare it off, you know. And so they heard this bird on and off. And then after a couple days, they had to go down there for some reason. So, you know, tiptoed down and tried not to disturb anything. And as he looked around, he couldn't find any sign of a bird. And then he noticed this fire alarm that was failing. It was beeping. That's what the sound was from. It was from this fire alarm. And after that, they found it so annoying, they ripped it out and called an electrician to come and get rid of it right away. So there was the raw sensation is just this chirping sound, and there's one, it extrapolates out and says, this is coming from a bird, this is wonderful. There's another extrapolation out that, no, this is coming from a faulty fire alarm system, I hate it.
But the
sensation is the same.
But one of them was correct. Yeah, I mean, you said the closest thing to reality is that the basic sensation, but what we do, but it seems to me that we put those pieces together. You know, we build models, and the models, you know, we test them, and hopefully over time the models get better. And there's other kinds of consciousness and everything. But it almost sounds like you're negating, I mean, science or anything.
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
We're all struggling to put pieces together, and we know the models aren't perfect, but they do actually work sometimes.
Absolutely. No, and we could not live without them. We could not live without them. You know, thought was a wonderful invention that actually allows us as a species to survive, you know, because we're, you know, biologically we're scavengers, so we have to kind of figure out what's going on and find out what works. So it's not that one is good and the other is bad. It's just that a sound is a sound and a thought is a thought. And let's not confuse them. It's not to say that one is better than the other. And there are all these phrases where the Buddha talks about feeling the body in the body, the feelings in the feelings, the mind in the mind, that sound almost impenetrable, but what he's actually saying is just to learn to experience them on their own terms. And so when you're thinking a thought, when you have a map of the world, to know that it's a map. And if you understand that it's a map, then when you walk, you know, find a door where there's not one on your map, then you change the map.
Let me see if I'm understanding.
Yeah.
The way I kind of look at this is that, you know, there's the, whatever the sensation is in the body, and then cognitive mind can jump in and make all sorts of things about it based on other.
Okay. So what I mean, let me I'm going to run through the rest of these real quickly, and then we'll come back to your question, because this gets at how they all work together. So there's raw sensation, and then from that, what arises out of raw sensation, the first thing that arises out of that is it's either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. It has a tone, right? And it's important to know that the feeling tone is not the same as the sensation, but it is a very real phenomenon. So that's it's vedana, and it's usually is the second khanda, is these feeling tones. It's usually translated as feeling, but it gets confused with emotion. It's just pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And then what happens, that all you're hinting at, is the third one, sunya, is perception. And what happens in perception is we take the raw sensations, and the feeling tone, and run through this card catalog in our head that's bigger than the Library of Congress, and try to find something that matches up to it. It says, oh, that's what this is. And what happens at that point is this fluid sensation actually kind of solidifies. Stephen Levine, a teacher, a very poetic writer, was one of the first people to write about Theravadin, this insight meditation in this country. There's a book called The Gradual Awakening. And he was for a while he worked as a tour guide in the Southwest, in some of the wilderness areas. And there were scientists that would come through, and he didn't know a lot about flora and fauna and stuff, but he knew where the dangers were, so he could lead these people around. And so they would hire him, to keep him safe and get him back and stuff like that. And he was talking about one time being out there with this group of ornithologists. And one of them looked up and said, ah, there's a vermilion flycatcher. And Stephen Levine said in his mind, the whole thing shifted. There was this crimson stream of aliveness that suddenly became vermilion flycatcher. And so what perception is, from a Buddhist perspective, is this thing of putting labels on things. And they're very helpful. They help simplify the world. They help us navigate. Red light, stop. You don't have to figure it all out again. It's very simple. But you want to make sure that you make it. You see the difference between a cow and a picture of a cow. Okay. So sensation creates a feeling tone. The mind interprets it, and it solidifies. Becomes a noun rather than a verb, if you will. And then we have a field day. We start thinking about it. There's all our concepts, our ideas, put all that in the storylines. That's the fourth kanda. And this culture, probably a lot of cultures, it's probably more just basically humans. We really love the stories and stuff we can create. And the woman said that is not a cow, but actually she must have seen that it was a cow. It just was not her idea of a proper cow. Okay. And then the fifth one is awareness, vijnana. It's usually translated as consciousness, but in English the word consciousness has a whole lot of different meanings. And it really refers to awareness. So I don't want to talk much go about those, but go ahead.
I guess this is my game. More about it, but my question was more about this. Was I'm just wondering what your thoughts are about this, like in cognitive sciences, mm-hmm. you think of some sort of event that takes place after that sort of raw signal, mm-hmm. Like you said. There's some sort of interpretation first, and then there's some sort of determination of whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, and then feeling comes out of that. And so I'm wondering what your thoughts are about the difference of these, the order of these events, and whether that even matters.
I don't think it matters that much. I actually trust the Buddhists, because that's my experience of the two. But what happens is that it's not as linear as we think. So, for example, in Buddhism, thought can also be is also treated as a sensation. and there are thoughts that just arise. And so what happens in all of these is they loop around. So it does go from, and I think it does go from sensation to feeling tone to perception to thoughts. And then we may have some feelings about that thought. You know, that reminds me of so-and-so, and I don't like that person very much. Well, so now you're back in there. So it's not just one way and it's done. And it's also true that normally this stuff goes very, very fast. So normally you don't see them until the mind is really quiet.
Could you say something more about awareness? I feel like you just kind of said the word and didn't
say it. at the end of June, I'm doing a whole talk on the fifth kanda. And I want to say that because I'm going to go off the ranch a little bit.
Oh, come on.
Just a
little
bit.
So somebody help pass this out as I'm talking about these. This is your test. So what I'll say about it is that my deepest experience is that awareness is a fundamental property of the universe. There's matter, there's energy, there's space that we don't know how to measure. You can measure distance between objects, but how do you measure space? But without space, there wouldn't be anything. And then there's awareness. Okay? And there is pure awareness that is absolutely indivisible. And I think that it's a property of the universe, and our nervous system doesn't create awareness, it just amplifies it. And there's in deep meditation, when the mind gets quiet enough, some of the physiological systems will shut down. And there is still awareness. It feels very different. So that's a tease. So let's go through these. So what's the upper left image? What do you see? Pardon? Woody Allen.
A saxophone
player.
Beautiful lady.
A beautiful lady? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So when I look at it, I think it's a representation of Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. But that's just a concept. You know, that's an idea.
That's a different
map. Absolutely, it's a different map. Okay, and so the next one, the one on, oh, that was a top left.
Yes.
Okay, yeah, the top right, this one right here. So what do you see there?
A rabbit and a duck.
Right, rabbit and a duck.
Just look at it the other way.
Oh, I see.
Okay. Well, these are all redundant, but I just had a lot of fun putting these together. And so the one below the rabbit and duck.
It's
another rabbit and a duck. And so the one right in the middle. What's the first way you would describe that? Yeah, two triangles and three circles, right?
Pac-Man.
Yeah. Yeah, the reality is there are no triangles there. They're just a bunch of Pac-Man. But the way... right? And some Vs that are thrown around. But the way it's actually the ganglia of the eyes, that we are very sensitive to lines.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to focus on a blank wall, but you can see an edge and you just focus on it right there. So the eye and the brain just fills in the lines there that creates those little objects. Okay, and then the wheel there, there's a question of which way it's facing. And your extra credit homework assignment is if you look at the bottom right, and this is different, I just find this fascinating. Is that there are two triangles, right? Two large triangles, the one right at the very bottom, the one above it, And each of those triangles is made up of four objects. And the four objects are actually the same. They are identical in each. But somehow they're put together in the bottom one, so there's a whole extra square unit that's left out.
There's a face in the sax player. I can see it from the back. I can
yeah.
see you.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, over here too.
Right, yeah. Okay. Okay, so I'm playing around with this. So what does this have to do with the khandhas?
Perception.
Yeah. So first khanda, this one right here, is actually just light and dark from the standpoint of raw sensation, right? And maybe you find a pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And then you create a perception, which is a saxophone player and a woman. And what's really fascinating about that is it takes a very relaxed mind in order to see both of those at once. If you just try to see them, you notice it'll flip back and forth really, really quickly. It's very hard to see both of them because the mind wants to go one way or the other. So that's the perception. You know, that's the third kind of. And then there are the storylines. You know, I threw out Monica Lewinsky and Bill Clinton, and you know, so that you know, that's got a whole story behind it. And then there's the awareness, without which you wouldn't be able to perceive any of it. Okay. So, any questions before we... No, we're going to run out of time here. I brought some rewards for you. So, anybody want a Hershey's Kiss? Would you like one? Okay. So, So let's get into the practical application, you know, what's useful about sensations. And what I want to invite you is to just say or share something that you've experienced in meditation, particularly sensations, and we'll talk a little bit about where they might come from. Yeah.
Almost like a tickling or numbing sensation on the top of my nose. It's like this, just like it brings up that I want to scratch it. But it's,
yeah.
But that's two steps, so it would be like a tingling sensation.
Right. Did anybody get those tingling? Or I used to get, well, I still do sometimes. It feels like one hair, the end of it is being pressed against my skin and then spun. So like this tickles like crazy. And there are some of those sensations, I mean, there are ones that come up from pains in the knee, that come up from real signals from the body that says, you know, something's being damaged here. And then there are also those strong sensations that sometimes come up that are really not being produced by the body itself. That... or it's not quite what it seems to be. And those are ones that when you move the slightest bit back, they disappear. So what I would have, I remember years ago, I'd be sitting in meditation, I would get this pain in my heart that, you know, first thought I was having a heart attack, but every time I moved, you know, it would just be gone instantly. I had stuff checked out enough, knew that's what's going on, but sometimes it's so much that I was actually tears coming down. But the slightest movement would just be gone. And they're called meditation pains. And there's lots of sensation like that. If you're getting a pain and you get up and you move and it doesn't go away, then probably don't want to sit that way. Or, you know, maybe need some adjustment. But if it goes away just instantly, then see if you can actually observe it with a relaxed mind. Other types of things, yeah.
Just last week when I was meditating and some other time here, I felt like my whole chair moved back.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, I opened my eyes and it's like, no, I'm still in the same place. But it was just such a strong physical sensation that I actually, the whole thing moved.
Yeah. Have any of you ever had the sensation that you're sitting there and it feels like you're sitting like this? And you open your eyes and actually the world is still... Because I think what happens when some of that is as the mind quiets down, we're used to feeling all these gross sensations, and as the mind relaxes and the body relaxes, the grosser sensations all fade, and what you're left with is subtler and subtler and subtler sensations that you're not used to feeling so often, and the brain doesn't know quite what to do with them, and will come up with all kinds of interpretations. And it feels very real, and you open up at some. And sometimes, if you've ever had the sensation of parts of your body just disappearing?
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah. And there's a disappearing, which is as in going to sleep, which, you get up and you walk on, and that's actually pressed on a blood vessel or nerve. But there's another disappearing that as soon as you... bring a lot of attention to it, or you just touch it, and it's right back. It's right back. How many of you experienced that? Great. So, in my system, that's actually a very typical of what's called the fourth jhana. That what happens is the body gets so relaxed, and the mind gets so relaxed that it just stops sending out signals. And all the physiology is still there, up and running. It works just fine. But there's just no signal coming in because it's so relaxed. And it's and if you know how to work with it, it's a sign of actually fairly deep equanimity. So another example of that is if you're sitting and meditating, and somebody knocks over a garbage can in the next room, and you're jolted. Mm-hmm. Or you're sitting there, somebody knocks over a garbage can in the next room, and it's just this wave that you're not pulled away at all. That's a very similar type of thing where it's just relaxed. And if you're doing one-pointed concentration, it draws you back, and it's a shock to come out of there. But if the mind is soft and open and relaxed and very receptive and very little tension, then you just feel the wave goes through you. But it doesn't throw you off at all.
Yeah. I noticed in the walking meditation, at the beginning of the walking meditation, I've had really strong feelings. It's like, why did I wear these shoes? It's like not being very clumsy and not being able to really, it's like I'm you're noticing how you're walking and it feels really weird, and then as you continue on through, you feel very solid and very stable and very balanced.
Yeah.
And very, but at the beginning, if I remember, we were up in the vineyards up at Heather had a day long, and I was like, why did I wear these shoes? You know, it must be the shoes. It must be the shoes. And it was great to realize how grounded you could get.
Yeah. And when the body gets relaxed like that, it can feel awkward, and it takes a little bit of time to get your sea legs to kind of get used to that, and then it all stabilizes again. So here's another one that you might not think of as a sensation, but if any of you have ever been sitting and meditating and get a song stuck in your head?
Yeah. What
did
you say?
A song or melody going through your head? Yeah. That is actually quite instructive of how the mind works. Because I struggled with those for years, and I would notice, there's this song going on, and it's, the first verse, and I'd bring my attention back to the breath, and then a minute later it goes back, it's on the third verse, and like it just kept playing even if I wasn't there. And when I was doing concentration meditation, I was always trying to, get away from it. But as I started doing this broader awareness one, I would still get annoyed at it, and then I sort of realized, well, it's there, and why don't I just see what's going on? And got really curious to go from, because song going on is actually much more conceptual, right? So there is a thought sensation, And so to see how much, if I could get down to what it is I'm actually experiencing in the moment. Does that make sense? So there's this line going on, and any moment, you know, all you're going to hear in the mind is like one point in that. But there's something projected out on this whole thing. So it's like to try to get back down to just really, really open and aware of the actual sensation in the mind. And what happened is it slowed down. And it got slower and slower and slower and slower until there was just one sound left. Mm-hmm. And then if I let my mind tighten up a little bit, then the melody would start up. And I just kind of softened into it, and it would stop. And I realized that what's actually going on is that there's, again, in Buddhism, the mind perceives thoughts. And so there's this thought that's a sound, and then it's pleasant or unpleasant, and you label it as a thought, and then the mind has an idea of where it goes, and it starts to fill it in. And so you think you're listening to this thing doing itself, but your mind is actually creating this. The theme song to Beverly Hillbillies, that kept going for me at one point.
It just reminded me of something, maybe you know more about this, but there were some visiting lamas mm-hmm. who came, and they were they mentioned something about finding that we all kind of have a tone, mm-hmm. you know, and so that when you quiet down, you know, hearing that tone, mm-hmm. and actually being able to make that tone, recognizing what that is. Mm-hmm. You seem to think that was kind of important or interesting.
Right. I don't have any comment on that. You know, it's actually not part of the Theravadan system, but the lamas that I've known, I just think, boy, I'd like to be like them when I grow up. So there's a lot of wonderful stuff. But yeah, they do use tones and visualizations and lots of different stuff like that.
I don't know where this would fit in, but when I was on a retreat, it was not so much a song, but like a dance, walking meditation. Mm-hmm. I was doing it more with Thich Nhat Hanh, like just taking the environment.
Yeah.
And my body just needed to take the shape of the trees, like in the dance.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't feel like I was deciding to do this. It was just, but it was a very peaceful.
So I don't know exactly what was going on there, but some of my experiences like that, what I think happens is, it's the fifth jhana. It gets very, very spacious. It's called the base of infinite space. And usually, if there are thoughts going on in your mind, there's this subjective experience that I'm here watching these thoughts. And so there's some space between the two of them. And if you can... and this is a trick, is actually to relax the mind and stay aware at the same time. This is a game you can play at night. I used to do this on retreats. I would lie in bed at night before I went to sleep and see if I could be as present as I could and fall asleep with my eyes open, still working. So it was, and I sort of realized later after I had all this fun with it, it's actually an exercise in remaining aware while you get deeply, deeply relaxed. And part of what happens when that is the distance between what it, or as Piaget would say, who it is it seemed to be perceiving and what it is seemed to be perceived gets narrow, it gets, they get closer and closer and closer together until there's just this flow of experience. You know, there's an awareness of tree, but not awareness so much of a self that's separate from that perceiving the tree. It's just this flow. It's just this flow of experience. And it takes a pretty deeply relaxed mind to do that. But nature has a way of kind of supporting that. I have a whole long list. We're going to run out of time. Does any of you ever with your eyes closed get a fluttering around the peripheral vision?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I'll just say it, you know, it may not sound credible. But what that usually is you're actually seeing individual consciousnesses arise and pass. So it's, so I had this experience on a retreat with John Travis once of doing a walking meditation and deeply relaxed, and just in the field of vision, things were flowing through. And then they stopped flowing, they were just like separate frames. It's just jerk. And this is a subtler but a much more common phenomena of the mind gets so relaxed that the consciousness begins to break up a little bit. The awareness begins to fall apart. And I think the reason it happens in the periphery is that the center of our vision, we focus on it all the time, and that's deeply conditioned, but we don't pay that much attention out here, so it's actually more relaxed. Barbara, did you have something?
Oh, I was just going to say that this typically happens on retreat, which started 5 or 6 years ago. I get hot flashes, and one has menopause syndrome. But they got to be a really good way just to observe impermanence, because and they come in waves, so that the 5 or 6 or 7 successive ones, but I could observe the start and how they started sort of in the core and they go out, mm-hmm. and then they dissipate, and then another one comes. And, you know, once I was realized this was just a phenomenon of the body. And I guess it's not uncommon. I talked to some teachers about it, and they said, you know, it happens mostly to women.
Yeah, I think there's two things that can happen then. Once, you know, in Tibet, these lamas would go out and have these contests. They would go out in with these wet, frozen blankets and wrap them around their bodies and see who could dry them off the fastest by producing body heat. I don't recommend that. That's just sort of fun and games with it. But the other thing that happens, again, as the mind gets really quiet, is that there are these subtler and subtler phenomena, and the mind is very still, and it's very subtle phenomena, but they seem huge because the mind is so quiet. And so there can be just very subtle fluctuations that you're so sensitive to that they seem really, really extreme. Yeah.
I guess I just have to say from a science perspective that I've kind of always had this thing that you have, that when you're in these deep trances, you really switch your autonomic nervous system onto a different situation. And so you're almost having backfiring of automatic responses. So like in your eyes, you're actually having synapses that haven't turned off yet. And you normally aren't aware of that, that comes on. If you do, you're pretty much in a meditative state, completely turning off the sympathetic nervous system for the most part.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's a lot of truth to that, and you can see that, and then there are also subtler phenomena that are very, very different from that. It's getting up towards 9 o'clock.
George.
What was that?
I have my hand up. So I often experience, you know, the sense of being really tall.
Uh-huh.
So... and I'm not very tall, so
there's this friend of mine who is like I think he's 5'5", but he grew up faster than anybody else, and so all through grade school and stuff he was taller than everybody else, and he reached 5'5" and just stopped and everybody passed him, and he still has this internal body sense of being taller than everybody. Even though he knows, he's looking up to people. So yeah, it's another situation where you get, you know, an internal map, you know, an image that's just recorded somewhere in the brain, and it takes on a life of its own. And they're kind of fun to look at, you know, it's kind of fun to see.
I have a corollary to Barbara's, and it happens when I meditate here at SIM, and it's that my head gets on fire.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like almost sometimes so intense I think I gotta stop this. I gotta get out of here.
Right. Yeah.
But it doesn't happen at home, at least that I remember. another interesting aspect of that is that, you know, like at the end of our meditations, you know, I'll go out and start, the people say, wow, you got a lot of sun today. I mean, it is a physiological thing as well as, well, psychological, I guess. And I find it interesting that it happens here but not at home.
Yeah, well, there's something about being in a collective energy field, and that's probably some of what this guy was saying there about it. What I think is most important, so from my perspective of looking at this as a wisdom meditation as opposed to a serenity meditation, is what we're always interested in seeing is any ways that the mind is distorted. And of course, the thing that distorts the mind most quickly is wanting or aversion or indifference. And so when something like that comes up, there can be all that thing, it's, well, you know, what's going on, et cetera, et cetera. It can be, you know, if you can see for a moment whether there's, you know, a little bit of fear or a little bit of aversion or something like that, and see if you can feel a tension in that and just allow that to soften a little bit. You allow the fear and the storylines just to do their thing, but sort of relax the tension in it. So I found that I used to produce a tremendous amount of body heat when I was meditating. You know, I was teaching classes, I'd be, you know, in shorts and a t-shirt and barefoot, you know, thing up, and everybody would be wrapped up in blankets, you know. But as I found, as I shifted to the style, it has so much of the relaxation built into it. It doesn't happen as much anymore. I kind of miss it. It sort of made me feel special or something. But that's kind of gone. Maybe it's just getting old. I don't know. So I want to take just a moment and just come back to this question of so what?
The question
of what? So what? What's useful about all this? So any of your thoughts about that? Now what's helpful about this? Ginger.
Well, when I sit for a long time, like when I'm on a day long, I mean, not just in 40 minutes, but for a long time, I see myself like things aren't as important as I think they are, and images seem like they change, and the things that I feel shift. There's a shift in perception, and the heaviness gets lighter and lighter.
Yeah, good, good, good. So do you want me to volunteer? So what? Go ahead.
I mean, it seems like you said it right at the very beginning, that Buddhism is a phenomenology, and what you've been talking about, these aggregates really are the phenomena of our humanness, of our awareness to sensation, to the body, to the that which we are given, the thinking, and the stories that we create, and the awareness. I mean, this is our endowment. Mm-hmm. So to sort of see its progression of sorts, and I think can have some, bring some clarity.
And one place I think where that clarity comes is right back to the Picasso's cow, is to people try to think their way out of feelings, you know, and they're actually different universes. The only thing you can do is you create enough thoughts that you suppress the feeling, you don't notice it anymore, but it's still there, and eventually in this process of getting free, we really have to deal with all of them on their own terms. You know, feel the feelings that I'm talking about, emotions and all that, is to feel the storylines within them. And when you have this big storyline that comes up around a feeling, it's like to know, okay, that's a storyline. It is just a storyline. It's amazing that we believe our thoughts.
Yeah, that's where I was going with it too.
Yeah.
That, you know,
It reminds me kind of dependent origination. And if it's kind of like a negative feeling tone and a negative story, it's very helpful, I've found, to break it down and be like, okay, this is reactivity. Okay, this is feeling tone. This is unpleasant, and then kind of take some of the charge off.
Right.
And then if it's really pleasant, you can kind of how to bump it up, as long as you don't get stuck in craving. But you can kind of see, well, this is pleasant. Well, this is this is here. So.
Yeah, as long as you can relax into the pleasantness, right. It's just only when you grasp onto it, but to relax into it. I had my father was a really wonderful father, and then he was kind of neglectful, and then he was borderline psychotic and kind of crazy, and then he was a this really kind of open heart bumbling through the world. Of course, he didn't change at all. And so I just look back at all these things that I thought were so true. And so I think right now I have these thoughts about what's going on.
Yeah.
And so part of what it does for me is actually leave me a little bit humble about, what I think is actually going on now. And so I don't get so caught, or try to not get so caught in the stories. I mean, use them, they're useful. But actually, kind of stay open so you can get fresh information in.
My thoughts on it was that it seems there's a lot of commonality. And so sharing what I may be experiencing, it's easier to get guidance, maybe, or if I'm hung up on something and then realize that, oh, this is normal, or this is common,
right.
or this is something that a lot of people get cut off on, and here's a technique to get past that. So the commonality of a lot of experiences, and people with more experience can relate, and there is maybe a map.
This does unfold. It's a little bit different for everybody, but not a lot different. Not a lot different for each of us.
I think it's a real practical everyday value in knowing that these sensations trigger your thoughts and your affect about it. The example you gave, of the chirping, being a positive sound because they thought they had a bird, and
right.
It became an obnoxious sound when they had something else.
Right.
And I live right near a freeway,
mm-hmm.
And if I'm outside, I can really focus. Initially, when I first moved there, oh my God, freeway's really bad. All the horrible, or at least negative, tone and interpretations you have about that. I was coming back from the ocean, and I was thinking about. Why does being at the beach give you all these wonderful feelings, And I started thinking about the sound that you're hearing and the association. If you separate out the actual stimulus of the sound of the cars in the distance and the surf on the rocks from a distance, very close, they're very similar. And so all you have to do in your head is give it a different story. And once you know you can manipulate those things, I love to sit out there and I listen to the every week at least.
Well, and so the other thing you can do with that is actually see the story as a story and see the aversion as aversion, and let the story be whatever it is, and allow the aversion to relax. Because what you have as experiences with the same sensation, can be different. And so we always love the stories, but if you can get to the tension underneath it. I mean, that was the core of the Buddha's teachings. He said, second noble truth is that the source of our experience of suffering comes from this instinctual tightening that happens inside. And you feel it, an aversion, you feel liking. If you just relax that, everything else mellows out. So I think I'm going to stop with that because people have real lives and have to go to work tomorrow and all kinds of things like that. So let's take just a moment here to share some of that. So there's this idea of bodhicitta that says that, you know, when we meditate, when we do anything to improve ourselves, that it's actually the people around us benefit from it. Our families are happier that we're a little mellower. Right? So that we may think we're pursuing this practice for our own benefit, which is true, but there are people around us who benefit from it. And as they practice, we benefit from theirs, whether that's their intention or not. So sensing this, how we are all deeply interrelated and connected together, spend a few moments just sending out through all those connections, all those ways that we touch each other. May all beings be peaceful. May all beings know their true nature, who they truly are. May all beings be at ease. May all beings have sweet dreams. May it be so, blessed be. Thank you for your practice. Thank you for coming. Thank you for being here. Thank you for supporting me in my meditation. It's always great to meditate with a group.